total honesty. I'm sorry. I told her everything. What am I missing? Kate isn't an idiot. You told her you were investigating her? There was heat in Pilcher's words. You think she wouldn't have immediately assumed that? We'll never know now, will we? David, will we? I know her. You don't. Pam said, So you told her we were on to her, and she said, Great, here's what's going on. I told her that she was under suspicion, and that I could protect her. Played up those old feelings, huh? Something like that. Okay, might not be the worst approach. So what'd you learn? She says the last time she saw Alyssa was on Main Street the night she died. They parted ways. Alyssa was still alive. What else? She has no idea what's beyond the fence. Asked me repeatedly. Then why is she running around in the middle of the night? I don't know. She wouldn't tell me. But I have a chance to find out. When? Tonight. But I need my chip taken out. Pilcher looked at Pam, back to Ethan. Not possible. Her note explicitly said, no chip or don't bother coming. So just tell her you took it out. You think they won't check? We can make an incision in the back of your leg. They'll never know the difference. What if they have some other way of finding out? Like what? Fuck if I know. But if there's a microchip in my leg tonight, I'm staying home. I made that mistake with Alyssa. Let her go dark. If she'd been chipped, we'd already know where she went. Where she was killed. I won't make that mistake again. I can handle myself, Ethan said. You've both seen that, firsthand. Maybe we aren't as concerned, Pam said, with your safety as we are with your loyalty. Ethan turned in his chair. He'd fought this woman once in the basement of the hospital. She'd come at him with a syringe, and he'd crashed into her at full speed, driven her face into a concrete wall. He relived that moment now like the memory of a good meal, wishing he could experience it again. She raises a point, Ethan, Pilcher said. And what point is that? You don't trust me? You're doing great, but it's still early times. Lots to prove. I want the chip out, or I don't go. It's that simple. Pilcher's voice assumed a harder edge. You will be in my office crack of dawn tomorrow with a full report. Is that understood? Yes. And now I have to threaten you. With what will happen to my family if I should decide to run or otherwise misbehave? Can't I just imagine the worst and assume you'll deliver? What I really need is to have a word with you in private. Ethan glanced at Pam. You don't mind, do you? Of course I don't mind. When the door had closed behind her, Ethan said, I'd like to get a better picture of who your daughter was. Why? The more I know her, the better chance I'll have of finding out what happened to her. I think we know what happened to her, Ethan. I was down in the quarters yesterday. There were flowers and cards all around her door. A real outpouring. But I was wondering, did she have any enemies in the mountain? I mean, she was the boss's daughter. Ethan thought Pilcher might erupt at this intrusion into his privacy and grief. But instead, Pilcher leaned back in his chair and said, almost wistfully, Alyssa was the last person to trade on her status. She could have lived in this suite with me in luxury, done whatever she wanted. But she insisted on keeping Spartan living quarters, and she took assignments just like everyone else. Never once sought out preferential treatment because of who she was. And everyone knew. And it made everyone love her even more. Did you two get along?
Yes.
What did Alyssa think about all this? All what? The town, the surveillance, everything.
Early on, after we all came out of suspension, she had her idealistic moments.
You mean she didn't agree with how you ran Wayward Pines?
Right. But by the time she hit 20, she'd begun to really mature. She understood the reasons behind the cameras and the fates, the fence and the secrets. How did she become a spy? Her request. The assignment came up. There were a lot of volunteers. We had a big fight about it. I didn't want her to do it. She was just 24. So bright. So many other things she could have contributed to that wouldn't have put her in danger. But she stood here and said to me several months ago, "I'm the best candidate for this mission, Daddy." You know it. I know it. Everyone knows it. So you let her go. As you'll find with your son soon enough, letting go is the hardest, greatest thing we can do for them. Thank you, Ethan said. I feel like I know her a little bit now. I wish you'd really gotten the chance. She was something else. Halfway to the doors, Ethan stopped, glanced back at Pilcher. Mind if I ask one more prying question? Pilcher smiled sadly. Sure. Why stop now? Alyssa's mother. Where is she? It was like something broke inside the man's face. He looked suddenly old, as if the underpinnings had been washed away. Ethan instantly regretted asking. The air was sucked out of the room. Pilcher said, "Out of everyone who went into suspension, 9 people never woke up on the other side. Elizabeth was one of those 9. Now I've lost my daughter too. Hug your family tonight, Ethan. Hold them tight." The OR was down on level 2, and the surgeon was waiting for them. He was a roundish man with a bowed back and awkwardness of movement, as if his bones had atrophied after years of living in this mountain, and too little exposure to sunlight. His white coat dropped to his wingtips, and he was already wearing a surgical mask. As Ethan and Pam entered, the doctor looked up from a sink that ran steaming tap water. He washed his hands furiously, didn't introduce himself, just said, "Take off your pants and lie on your stomach on the table." Ethan looked at Pam. "You are staying for this? You honestly think I'd pass up a chance to watch you get cut?" Ethan sat down on a stool and began to pull off his boots. Everything had been prepped. Spread out on blue surgical cloth on a tray beside the operating table, a scalpel, tweezers, forceps, sutures, needle, scissors, needle holder, gauze, iodine, and a small, unlabeled bottle. Ethan tugged his boots off, buckled his belt, and dropped his khaki pants. The floor was cold through his socks. With his elbow, the surgeon shut off the tap. Ethan climbed onto the table and lay on his stomach on the cloth. There was a mirror on the wall across the room beyond the heart monitors and IV stands. He watched the doctor finish pulling on his surgical gloves and wander over. "How deep is the microchip?" Ethan asked. "Not terribly," the doctor said. He opened the bottle of iodine, poured some onto a cloth, scrubbed the back of Ethan's left leg. "We affixed them to the bicep femoris." The doctor jabbed the syringe into the smallest bottle. "Few little pinches coming," he said. "What's in that?" "Just a local anesthetic." Once the back of his leg was numb, it went fast. Ethan couldn't feel a thing, but in the reflection of the mirror, he watched the doctor lift the scalpel. He felt some pressure. Soon there were smears of blood on the doctor's latex gloves. A minute later, he traded the scalpel for the tweezers. 20 seconds later, the microchip plunked into the metal tray beside Ethan's head. It looked like a flake of mica. "Do me a favor," Ethan said as the doctor pushed a piece of gauze into the wound. "What's that?" "Do a sloppy job on the sutures." "Smart," Pam said. "It'll buy you some cake cred if she thinks you cut it out yourself. Like maybe you're going rogue." "That's what I'm thinking." The doctor lifted the needle holder, a length of dark thread dangling. The pain from the incision was beginning to warm in the back of Ethan's leg as he and Pam moved down the level one corridor toward the cavern. Ethan stopped at the door to Margaret's cell, leaned in toward the glass window, and cupped his hands around his eyes.
"What are you doing?" Pam asked.
"I want to see her again."
"You can't." He squinted through the glass into darkness.
"Couldn't see a thing."
"Have you worked with her?" Ethan asked.
"I have."
"What do you think of her?"
"She should be put in the incinerator with all of our specimens. Come on."
Ethan looked at Pam. "You see no benefit to learning from the Abbeys? They do outnumber us by a few hundred million."
"Oh, you mean so we can coexist? What kind of let's-hold-hands hippie shit are you suggesting?"
"Survival," Ethan said. "What if they aren't all mindlessly violent? If they actually possess a real intelligence, then communication is possible."
"We have everything we need in Wayward Pines. We can't live in this valley forever."
"How do you know that?"
"Because I don't consider the conditions in town living."
"What would you call it?"
"Imprisonment."
He turned back to the cage. Margaret's head filled the circular window inches away. She stared into Ethan's eyes, lucid, utterly calm.
"A penny for your thoughts," he said.
Her black talons began to tap against the glass. Chapter 16. It was a two-bedroom Victorian on the northeast side of town, freshly painted, with two pine trees in the front yard and Wayne Johnson's last name already stenciled on the black mailbox. Ethan stepped up onto the front porch and rapped the brass knocker. After a moment, the door opened. A rotund, balding, gray-skinned man looked up at Ethan, squinting against the light. He wore a bathrobe, and what hair he still had looked slept on and uncombed.
"Mr. Johnson?" Ethan said.
"Yes?"
"Hi, I just wanted to swing by and introduce myself. I'm Ethan Burke, Sheriff of Wayward Pines."
It felt strangely dirty, claiming that position. The man stared at him, confused.
"Would it be all right if I came in for a minute?"
Sure.
The house still smelled unlived in and sterile. They sat at a small kitchen table. Ethan took off his Stetson and unbuttoned his parka. Casserole dishes and plates wrapped in tinfoil lined the counters. Neighbors no doubt had been called and urged to bring lunch and dinner to Mr. Johnson during this first difficult week. The three plates within eyeshot looked untouched.
"Are you eating?" Ethan asked.
"Haven't really had much of an appetite. People have been bringing food over."
"Good, so you're meeting the neighbors." Wayne Johnson ignored this. The Wayward Pines welcome manual issued to each resident upon their arrival lay open across the table's faux wood veneer. 75 pages of dire threats, sugar-coated as suggestions for living a happy life in Pines. Ethan's first week as sheriff had been spent memorizing it cover to cover. The book was currently open to the page that explained how food was distributed through the winter months when the gardens were in deep freeze.
"They tell me," Wayne said, "that I'm going to be working soon."
"That's right." The man put his hands on his lap and stared at them.
"What will I be doing?"
"I'm not sure yet."
"Are you one of the people I can actually talk to?" the man asked.
"Yes," Ethan said.
"Right now you can ask me whatever you want, Mr. Johnson."
"Why is this happening to me?"
"I don't know."
"You don't know? Or you won't tell me?"
There was a section toward the beginning of the welcome manual entitled How to Handle Questions, Fears, and Doubts About Where You Are. Ethan pulled the manual over and thumbed through that section. "This chapter might offer you some guidance," Ethan said. He felt like he was reading off a very bad script, which he didn't believe in.
"Guidance for what? I don't know where I am. I don't know what happened to me, and no one will tell me anything. I don't need guidance. I need fucking answers.
I understand your frustration, Ethan said. Why doesn't the phone work?
I've tried to call my mother 5 times. It just rings and rings.
That isn't right. She's always home, always by the phone.
Ethan had been in Wayne Johnson's shoes not long ago, frantic, terrified, coming unhinged as he ran around town trying to make contact with the outside world. Pilcher and Pam had set out to make Ethan believe he was losing his mind. That had been their integration plan for him from the start. Wayne Johnson's was different. He was getting what most people got, several weeks to explore town, explore the boundaries, and have several freakouts before the tough love kicked in.
I walked the road out of town this morning, Wayne said.
Guess what?
It just looped back around into town.
That isn't right.
Something's off. I just drove here a couple days ago. How is it possible that the road I came in on is no longer there?
Look, I understand you have some questions, and
where am I?
His voice filled the house.
What the hell is this place?
His face was red and he was shaking. Ethan heard himself say, It's just a town, Mr. Johnson. And the scary thing was, he hadn't even considered his answer. It had just sprung out of him like it had been programmed. He hated himself for it. He'd been told that very thing over and over during his integration.
The man said, Just a town? Yeah, just a town where you aren't allowed to leave or have contact with the world outside.
Understand something, Ethan said. Every person in Wayward Pines has sat where you sit, including me.
It gets better.
Congratulations. Now you're out and out lying to the man.
I'm telling you that I want to leave, Sheriff. That I don't want to be here any longer. That I want to go home. Back to my life like it was before. What exactly do you say to that?
It's not possible.
Not possible for me to leave?
That's right.
And what authority do you think you have to hold me here against my will?
Ethan stood. He was beginning to feel sick.
What authority? The man asked.
The sooner you make your peace with your new life here, the better things will be for you.
Ethan put on his hat. The back of his leg was beginning to hurt.
I wish you'd just say what you mean, Mr. Johnson said.
I'm sorry?
If I try to leave, you'll kill me. That's the gist of it, right? The hard bit of truth you've been dancing around?
Ethan patted the welcome manual.
Everything's here, he said. All you need to know. Inside the town is life. Outside is death. It's really that simple.
As Ethan walked out of the kitchen and back toward the front door, Wayne Johnson called after him.
Am I dead?
Ethan's hand was on the doorknob.
Please, Sheriff, just tell me. I can handle it. Did I die in that accident?
He didn't need to look back to know the man was crying.
Is this hell?
It's just a town, Mr. Johnson.
As Ethan walked outside, a single thought ran through his head. Pam would be proud. And he felt, for the first time in his life, truly evil. Ethan timed his walk home from work to stop by the jewelry store and then to pass by Teresa's real estate office just as she was quitting for the day. He rounded the corner onto Main, the back of his leg throbbing at the incision site. The sky had gone overcast and the street lamps were on and it was bitterly cold. There she was, a half block down, locking up for the night. She wore a gray, woolen trench coat and a knit hat that tied under her chin. Just a few sprigs of blonde hair poked out. She hadn't seen him yet, and as she fought to tug the key out of the lock, the vacancy in her face broke something inside of him. She looked shattered, threadbare. He called her name. She glanced back at him. She was in a dark place. He could see that instantly. would have bet money she'd been fighting tears all day. He reached her and put his arm around her. They walked together down the sidewalk. There were a handful of people out, locking up shops, walking home from work. He asked how her day was, and she said, "Fine," in a voice that undercut the meaning of the word. They moved catty corner across the intersection of 6th Street. Teresa said, "I can't do this." There were tears in her voice now, her throat clogged with emotion. "We need to talk," he said. "I know, but not here, not like this."
"Can they hear us now?"
"If we aren't careful." "Speak softly and stare at the ground. There's something I didn't tell you last night."
"What?"
Ethan hooked his arm around her waist, pulled her in close, said, "Hang on a second." They went past a street lamp on the corner that Ethan knew housed a camera and a microphone. When they were 50 feet from the lamp, he said, "Were you aware there's a microchip in the back of your leg?"
"No."
"It's how they track you."
"Do you have one too?"
"I just had mine removed temporarily."
"Why?"
"I'll explain later. I want to take yours out. It's the only way we'll be able to really talk." Their house stood a little ways down the hill.
"Will it hurt?" she asked.
"Yes. I'll have to cut you. We'll do it in the chair in the study."
"Why there?"
"It's a blind spot in our house. The only one. The cameras can't see us there." Her lips curled into the tiniest smile.
"So that's why you always want me in the study."
"Exactly."
"Sure you can do this?"
"I think so. Are you up for it?" Teresa drew in a deep breath, blew it out.
"I will be."
Ethan stood under the archway between the kitchen and the dining room, staring at Ben, who sat at the table, swallowed in a big coat with a blanket draped over his shoulders. The only sound in the house was the squiggle of the boy's pencil across a sheet of paper. "Hey, buddy," Ethan said. "How goes it?"
"Good."
Ben didn't look up from his drawing. "What are you working on?" Ben pointed at the centerpiece of the table, a crystal vase holding a bouquet of flowers that had long since succumbed to the interior cold. Cast-off, colorless petals wilted on the table around the base of the vase. "How was school today?"
"Good."
"What'd you learn?" This snapped Ben out of his concentration. It was an honest slip, a holdover from Ethan's life before. The boy looked up, confused. Ethan said, "Never mind." Even inside the house, it was cold enough for Ethan to see his son's breath. The rage came out of nowhere. He turned suddenly and walked down the hallway, jerked open the back door, crossed the deck into the yard. The grass was yellowed, dying. The row of aspen trees that separated their property from the neighbors had dropped their leaves practically overnight. The floor of the woodshed was still littered with scraps of bark and chips of pine from last year's load. Prying the axe out of the flat-topped splitting stump, Ethan had a vision of Teresa out here, chopping firewood alone in the cold, him still in suspension. He stormed back into the house, dark energy riding on his shoulders. Teresa was in the dining room with Ben, watching him sketch.
"Ethan, everything okay?"
"Fine," he said. The first strike split the coffee table down the middle, its two sides caving inward.
"Ethan, what the hell?"
Teresa in the kitchen now.
"I can see," Ethan raised the axe, "my son's fucking breath inside our fucking house."
The next strike devastated the left half of the table, fracturing the oak into three pieces.
"Ethan, that's our furniture."
He looked at his wife. "Was our furniture. Now it's heating fuel. There a copy of the paper lying around?"
"In our bedroom."
"Mind getting it?" By the time Teresa returned with the wayward light, Ethan had broken the coffee table into small enough pieces to put inside the stove. They wadded up sheets of newsprint and stuffed them under the kindling. Ethan opened the damper, lit the paper. As the fire grew, he called for Ben. The boy appeared, sketchpad under his arm.
"Yes?"
"Come draw by the fire." Ben looked at the butchered coffee table. "Come on, son." The boy took a seat in a rocker beside the wood stove. Ethan said, "I'll leave the door open for you.
When that fire gets going, add another piece.
Okay.
Ethan looked at Teresa, cut his eyes toward the hall. He grabbed a plate from the kitchen and followed her back to the study, locked them inside. The light coming through the window was gray, weak, and fading. Teresa mouthed, "You are sure they can't see us in here?" He leaned in, whispered, "Yeah, but they will be able to hear." He sat her down in the chair, touched his finger to her lips. Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out a slip of paper, which he'd folded 30 minutes ago at the station. Teresa opened it. "I need access to the back of your left leg. Take off your pants and turn over. I'm sorry, but this is going to hurt a lot. You have to keep quiet. Please trust me. I love you so much." She looked up from the note, scared. Reaching down, she began to unbutton her jeans. He helped her slide them down her thighs, something inescapably erotic as he tugged them off, the impulse to keep going, to keep undressing her. Was, after all, their fuck chair. Teresa turned crosswise and extended her legs into the air like she was stretching. Ethan moved around to the side of the chair. 90% sure he was out of view of the camera, which, from what he'd seen in Pilcher's office, aimed down at the bookshelf across the room. He set the plate on the floor and removed his coat. Kneeling down, he opened one of the large flap pockets and took out everything he'd raided from his office that afternoon. Bottle of rubbing alcohol, handful of cotton balls, gauze, tube of superglue, penlight, a pair of forceps he'd pocketed from the OR in the superstructure, a Spyderco harpy. He stared at the back of Teresa's left leg as the scent of wood smoke crept in from the living room under the door. It took him a moment to zero in on the old, white incision scar, which resembled the footprint of a tiny caterpillar. Opening the bottle of rubbing alcohol, he held a cotton ball to the mouth and turned it upside down. The sharp, bright smell of isopropyl filled the room. He wiped the wet cotton ball across her scar and then scrubbed down the plate. He opened the Spyderco folder. Its blade was an evil-looking piece of cutlery, fully serrated and curved to a point like the claw of a bird of prey. He wet another cotton ball and sterilized the blade and then the forceps. Teresa watched him, the look in her eyes something akin to horror. He mouthed, "Don't watch." She nodded, lips pursing, tension hardening her jawline. When he touched the knife to the top of the scar, her body went rigid. He didn't have the nerve built up to just start cutting her, but he dove in anyway. Teresa sucked a hard breath through her teeth as the blade entered. Ethan's eyes fixed briefly on her hands, balled into sudden fists. He detached himself. The blade was psycho-sharp, but this was a small gift. With no resistance, like cutting warm butter, he pulled it easily down the length of his wife's scar. It didn't feel like he was hurting her, but her face was scrunched and turning red while her knuckles blanched and a straight line of blood ran down the back of her leg. He remembered this look on her face. That fiercely beautiful determination. Night of their son's birth. The knife point was in a quarter, maybe half an inch, and he wondered if he'd gone deep enough to expose the muscle. He carefully withdrew the blade and laid it on the plate. Blood coated the end of the harpy with the consistency of motor oil. The beads and spatters popped on the white porcelain. Teresa's panties were stained red and blood pooled in the crevices of the chair. Ethan took the forceps. He turned on the penlight and stuck it between his teeth, leaned in close to study the new incision. With his left hand, he spread the mouth of the cut open. With his right, he worked the forceps inside the incision. Tears streamed down Teresa's face, her hair clutched in both hands. He doubted she could stand more cutting in the event he needed to go deeper. Slowly, he opened the forceps. Teresa made her loudest noise yet, something deep and guttural in the back of her throat. Her fingers clawing the upholstered arms of the chair. The hardest part was not offering her a single word of encouragement or comfort. He shined the penlight into the wound, saw the muscle. The microchip reflected a mother-of-pearl shimmer from the surface of Teresa's hamstring. He lifted the harpy off the plate. Steady hands.
Sweat burned in his eyes. Almost there, baby. He pushed the blade back into the wound as blood poured down her leg, Teresa flinching when the tip of the harpy touched the muscle, but he didn't hesitate. Ethan worked the knife point between the muscle and the chip and broke it free. He withdrew the blade, the microchip barely clinging to the end. He hadn't been breathing. Drew in a big gulp of air as he set the knife on the plate. Teresa, eyeing him, desperate to know. He nodded and smiled and picked up a handful of gauze. She grabbed it, held it to the back of her leg. Blood came through almost instantly, and Ethan handed her a fresh one. The worst of the pain seemed to be retreating, the flush leaving her face like a fever breaking. After 5 minutes, the flow became manageable. After 20, it had stopped altogether. Ethan wet one last cotton ball with alcohol and cleaned the incision site while Teresa cringed. Then he pinched closed the gaping wound, ripped the top off the superglue with his teeth, and squeezed out a generous bead, which he extended down the length of her cut. It was almost dark outside now and growing colder by the second inside the study. He held the incision close for 5 minutes, then let go. The adhesive held. Ethan moved around to the front of the chair and put his lips to Teresa's ear. "I got it out. You did amazing." "It was so hard not to scream." "The glue is working. Hold it closed, but you should stay put for a little while. Give it time to really set."
"I'm freezing."
"I'll bring you blankets." She nodded. He smiled at her. She still had tears in the corners of her eyes. She mouthed, "Let me see it." He lifted the harpy off the plate and held the end of the blade up to Teresa's face. The microchip sat in cooling blood that was becoming more and more viscous. The muscles in her jaw tensed with a flicker of anger. Violation. She looked at Ethan. No words spoken, but that didn't matter. He could see them written plainly across her face. Those fuckers. He picked the microchip off the knife, cleaned the blood and tissue with a piece of gauze, and presented it to her. Then he reached into his lapel pocket and lifted out the gold necklace he'd bought that afternoon. It consisted of a thin braided chain with a heart-shaped locket. She said,
"You shouldn't have."
Ethan opened the locket, whispered, "Keep the microchip inside the heart. Unless I tell you otherwise, you have to wear this necklace at all times." It was actually warm in the living room. Ben's cheeks glowed in the firelight. He was sketching the open wood stove, the flames, the blackening wood inside, the pieces of the smashed coffee table scattered around the base.
"Where's Mom?"
"Reading in the study. You need anything?"
"No."
"Let's not bother her for a while, okay? She's had a hard day." Ethan gathered up an armful of blankets from the stash under the sofa and headed back to the study. Teresa was shivering. He wrapped her up, said, "I'll make you something warm for dinner." She smiled through the pain.
"That'd be great."
Then he leaned in and whispered, "Come out in 1 hour. But no matter how much it hurts, walk straight. If they catch you limping on the cameras, they'll know." Ethan stood at the kitchen sink, staring into the blackness out the window. 3 days ago, it had been the end of summer, leaves just beginning to take on color. Jesus, fall had been a blink, from August to December in 72 hours. The fruit and veggies in the refrigerator were almost certainly the last fresh things they would eat for months to come. He filled a pot with water and put it on the range to boil, stuck a roomy saucepan beside it, turned the eye up to medium, and poured a spot of olive oil. They had 5 vine-ripened tomatoes left, just enough. A dinner plan percolated. He smashed a clove of garlic, diced an onion, dumped it all into the oil. While things sizzled, he chopped tomatoes. He could have been standing in their kitchen in Seattle. Late Saturday afternoons, he'd put on a Thelonious Monk record, open a bottle of red, and immerse himself in cooking a fabulous dinner for his family. No better way to unwind after a long week. This moment had the feel of those peaceful evenings, all the trappings of normal.
except that a half hour ago he'd cut a tracking chip out of the back of his wife's leg in the one spot in their house that wasn't under constant surveillance. Except for that. He added the tomatoes and crushed them into the onions and poured more oil and leaned over the stovetop into the sweet-smelling wafts of steam, trying, just for a beat, to embrace the fantasy. Teresa came out as he was rinsing the pasta. She was smiling, and he thought he sensed pain in it, a subtle strain, but there was no falter to her gait. They ate dinner as a family, on a blanket in the living room, crowded around the wood stove and listening to the radio. Hector Gaither was playing Chopin. The food was good, the heat enveloping, and it all passed too quickly. After midnight, Ben slept. They'd burned through the coffee table in 2 hours, and now the Victorian was plunging back into the deep freeze. Ethan and Teresa lay facing each other in bed. He whispered, "Are you ready?" She nodded. "Where's your necklace?"
"I'm wearing it."
"Take it off. Leave it on the bedside table." When she'd done it, she said,
"Now what?"
"We wait 1 minute." They dressed in the dark. Ethan looked in on their son, found the boy out cold. He walked downstairs with Teresa. Neither said a word. As he opened the front door, Ethan raised the hood of his black sweatshirt and motioned for Teresa to do the same. They went outside. Street lamps and porch lights punctuated the darkness, frigid and no stars. They walked out into the middle of the street. Ethan said, "We can talk now. How's your leg?"
"Agony."
"You're a rock star, babe." "I thought I was going to pass out. I wish I had." They moved west toward the park. Soon they could hear the river.
"Are we really safe out here?" Teresa asked.
"We're not safe anywhere. But at least without our chips, the cameras won't pick us up."
"I feel like I'm 15 again, sneaking out of my parents' house. It's so quiet."
"I love coming out late. You never crept out before? Not even once?"
"Of course not."
They left the street and wandered into the playing field. 50 yards away, the bulb of a single street lamp shone down on the swing set. They walked until they reached the end of the park, the edge of the river, sat down in the dying grass. Ethan could smell the water, but he couldn't see it. He couldn't see his hands in front of his face. Invisibility had never felt so comforting. "I shouldn't have told you," he said. "It was a moment of weakness. I just couldn't stand to have this lie between us. For us not to be on the same page."
"Of course you should have told me."
"Why?"
"Because this town is bullshit."
"But it's not like there's something better out there. If you ever dreamed of leaving Wayward Pines, I destroyed that sliver of hope."
"I'll take the truth any day. And I still want to leave."
"It's not possible."
"Anything's possible."
"Our family would be slaughtered in the first hour."
"I can't live like this, Ethan. I thought about it all day. I can't stop thinking about it. I won't live in a house where I'm spied on, where I have to whisper to have a real conversation with my husband. I'm done living in a town where my son goes to school and I can't know what he's being taught. Do you know what they're teaching him?"
"No."
"And you're fine with that?"
"Of course not."
"So fucking do something about it."
"Pilcher has 160 people living inside the mountain."
"There are 400 or 500 of us."
"They're armed. We're not. Look, I didn't tell you what was going on so you'd ask me to blow everything up."
"I won't live like this."
"What do you want from me, Teresa?"
"Fix it."
"You don't know what you're asking."
"You want your son growing up?"
"If burning this town to the fucking ground would make things just a little better for you and Ben, I would have torched it my first day on the job."
"We're losing him."
"What are you talking about?"
"It started last year. It's only getting worse."
"How?"
"He's drifting away, Ethan. I don't know what they're teaching him, but it's stealing him away from us. There's a wall going up."
"I'll find out."
"You promise?"
"Yes. But you have to promise me something."
"What?"
"You won't breathe a word of anything I've told you. Not a single detail to anyone."
I'll try my best.
One last thing.
What?
This is the first time we've been together in Wayward Pines without the cameras watching.
So?
He leaned over and kissed her in the dark. They walked through town. Ethan felt freezing motes begin to strike his face. He said, "Is that what I think it is?" In the distance, the light of a lonely street lamp became a stage for snowflakes. There was no wind. They fell straight down.
"Winter's here," Teresa said.
"But it was just summer several days ago."
"Summer's long. Winter's long. Spring and fall shoot past. The last winter went on for 9 months. The snow was 10 feet deep at Christmas."
He reached down and took hold of her mittened hand. Not a sound in the entire valley. Total hush. Ethan said, "We could be anywhere. Some village in the Swiss Alps. Just two lovers out for a midnight stroll."
"Don't do that," Teresa warned.
"Do what?"
"Pretend we're in some other place and time. The people who pretend in this town go mad."
They stayed off Main, kept to the side streets. The houses were dark, with no wood smoke in the valley. The snow-streaked air carried a clean, rinsed quality. Teresa said,
"Sometimes I hear screams and screeches. They're far away, but I hear them. He never mentions it, but I know that Ben hears them, too."
"Those are the Abbeys," Ethan said.
"Strange he's never asked me what the sound is. It's like he already knows."
They walked south beyond the hospital on the road that purported to lead out of town. Street lamps fell behind. Darkness closed in. A fragile quarter inch of snow dusted the pavement. Ethan said, "I paid a visit to Wayne Johnson this afternoon.
I'm supposed to take him dinner tomorrow night."
"I lied to him, Teresa. I told him this gets better. I told him it was just a town."
"Me too. But that's what they make you say, right?"
"Nobody can make me do anything. It's always a choice in the end."
"How's he doing?"
"How do you think? Scared, confused. He thinks he's dead and this is hell."
"Will he run?"
"Probably." At the edge of the forest, Ethan stopped. He said, "The fence is about a mile straight ahead."
"What are they like? The Abbeys?"
"Like all the bad things you have nightmares about when you're a kid. They are the monsters in the closet, under the bed. There are millions of them."
"And you're telling me we have a fence between us and them?"
"It's a big fence. Has electricity going through it."
"Oh, well, in that case."
"And there's a few snipers up on the peaks."
"While Pilcher and his people live in safety in the mountain."
Teresa walked a few steps down the road, the snow collecting on her shoulders, on her hoodie.
"Tell me something. What's the point of all those pretty little houses with white picket fences?"
"I think he's trying to preserve our way of life."
"For who? Us or him? Maybe someone should tell him our way of life is over."
"I tried."
"We should all be in that mountain, figuring something out. I'm not living the rest of my life in some psycho's model train town."
"Well, the man in charge doesn't share your view. Look, we aren't going to fix this tonight."
"I know."
"But we will fix it."
"You swear?"
"I swear."
"Even if it means losing everything?"
"Even if it means we lose our lives." Ethan stepped forward, opened his arms, pulled her in close. "I'm asking you to trust me. You have to go on like nothing has changed."
"That's going to make my psychiatrist appointments interesting."
"What appointments?"
"Once a month. I go to an appointment, talk to a skirt. I think everyone does. It's the only time we're allowed to open up to another human being. We get to share our fears, our thoughts, our secrets."
"You can talk about anything?"
"Yes. I thought you knew about these meetings."
Ethan felt his hackles rising. He pushed the rage back down. It wouldn't help him now. "Who do you see?" he asked. "A man? A woman?"
"A woman. She's very pretty."
"What's her name?"
"Pam."
He closed his eyes, drew in a deep,
cold shot of piney air.
"Do you know her?" Teresa asked.
"Yes."
"And she's one of Pilcher's?"
"She's pretty much his second in command. You can't tell her anything about tonight. Or your chip. You understand? Nothing. Our family would be killed."
"Okay."
"Has she ever inspected the back of your leg?"
"No."
"Has anyone?"
"No."
He checked his watch. 2:45 a.m. Nearly time. He said, "Look, I've got someplace to be. I'll walk you home."
"Seeing Kate again?" she asked.
"And her group. Pilcher's dying to know what they're up to."
"Let me come."
"I can't. She's expecting just me. If suddenly you show up too, things could get
awkward."
"It could spook her. Besides, she and her people might have killed someone."
"Who?"
"Pilcher's daughter. She was a spy. Point is, I don't know if they're dangerous or not."
"Please be careful."
Ethan took his wife's hand, and they turned back toward home. The lights of Wayward Pines looked hazy through the snow. He said, "Always, my love." Chapter 17. Standing in the forest among the pines, she thought there was nothing prettier than snowflakes falling through night vision. 10 years ago, there had been a forest fire 3 miles from the center of town. She'd stood in the burning trees watching embers rain down from the sky. This reminded her of that day, except the snow glowed green. Burning green, each flake leaving a luminescent trail in its wake, and the floor of the forest and the road and the snow-covered roofs of the houses in town, they all glowed like LED screens. The snow that had collected on Ethan's and Teresa's shoulders glowed too, as if they'd been sprinkled with magic dust. Pam didn't even have to hide behind a tree. As far as she could tell, Ethan hadn't brought a flashlight, and it was so dark out here in the woods, beyond the reach of street lamps and porch lights, that she had no fear of discovery. She needed only to stand in total silence, 15 feet away, and listen. She wasn't supposed to be here. Technically, she'd been sent to observe the new arrival, Wayne Johnson. It was his second night in Wayward Pines, and night 2 was historically a night for runners. But she was starting to think that Wayne might fall in line faster than the projections, that he wouldn't pose any significant problems. He'd been an encyclopedia salesman, after all. Something about the nature of his profession, at least to her, suggested conformity. So instead, she'd slipped into the empty house across from Ethan's Victorian and dug in behind the curtains in the living room with a straight-on view of his front door. Pilcher would be pissed that she'd abandoned her mission. There'd be a little hell to pay on the front side of this decision, but on the back, when her boss had finally calmed down and heard her out, he'd be thrilled with the results of her choice. She'd done it before with Kate Ballinger, staked out the woman's house at night for 2 weeks before she finally caught her leaving. But tracking her and her husband had been another story. Pam had lost her soon after, when Kate had literally disappeared underground. She'd tried to convince Pilcher to let her devote some real resources, but he'd shot her down since Alyssa was already on the case. "How'd that fucking work out for you?" Her opinion, the old man put up with way too much shit from his sheriff. She didn't get it, didn't understand what it was exactly that Pilcher saw in Burke. Yes, Ethan could handle himself. Yes, he had the skill set to run the town, but Jesus, no one was worth the trouble he'd put them through. If it was her call, and one day it would be, she'd have dealt with Ethan and his family 2 weeks ago. Chained Ben and Teresa to the pole beyond the fence. Let the Abbeys come for them. Sometimes she fell asleep imagining the screams of Ethan's son, picturing Ethan's face while he watched his boy and then his wife eviscerated and eaten before his eyes. She wouldn't feed Ethan to the Abbeys, though. She'd put him in lockup for a month, maybe 2. Hell, maybe a year, however long it took, make him watch and rewatch the Abbeys devouring his family, keep the footage rolling on an endless loop in his cell. The screams turned up,
and only when the man was broken in every way imaginable, when his body had wasted itself into nothing but a shell for a shattered mind, then, only then, she'd release him back into town. Give him a nice little job, maybe a waiter, maybe a secretary, something subservient, boring, soul-crushing. Of course, she'd check in on him each week. Hopefully, if she'd done it right, there would be just enough of his mind left to remember who she was and all that she had taken from him. And he would live out the rest of his days as a pathetic scab of a human being. That was how you dealt with men like Ethan Burke, with men who tried to run. You annihilated them. You made them a horrifying example for everyone to see. You sure as fuck didn't make them sheriff. She smiled. She had caught him. Finally. This fantasy that she'd been dreaming about as she lay in her room inside the mountain struck her, for the first time, as achievable. She wasn't exactly sure of what to do next, of how to use this ammunition to realize that dark, beautiful fantasy, but she would think of something. It made her so happy, standing in the dark between the pines with the burning specks of green falling all around her. She couldn't make herself stop smiling. Chapter 18. Ethan stood on the corner of Main and 8th, in front of the double doors that opened into the 400-seat opera house. The building had been locked up for the night, and through the glass, the lobby was dark, none of the framed movie or Broadway posters visible. Performances were held on a semi-regular basis, music recitals, community theater, town hall meetings. Classic movies were shown on Friday nights, and every 2 years, mayoral and city council elections were held here. Ethan checked his watch, 3:08 a.m. It wasn't like Kate to be 8 minutes late to anything. He buried his hands deep in his pocket. The snow had stopped. The cold was merciless. He shifted his weight between his feet, but the movement did little to warm him. A shadow appeared around the corner of the building and moved straight toward him, footsteps squeaking in the snow. He straightened. Not Kate. She didn't move like this and wasn't nearly as big. Ethan clutched the harpy in his pocket, thinking, "I should have left when she was 5 minutes late." That was a sign something was wrong. A man in a black hoodie stepped in front of him. He was taller than Ethan and wide through the shoulders, wore stubble on his face and reeked of the dairy. Ethan slowly tugged the folder out of his pocket, working the tip of his thumb into the hole in the blade. One flick, he'd have the knife open. One swipe, he'd have the man open. "That's a very bad idea," the man said. "Where's Kate?" "Here's what's going to happen. First, knife goes back in your pocket." Ethan slid his hand into his pocket, but he didn't let go of the knife. He recognized the man from his file photo, but he'd never seen him in town, and in this moment, outside in the cold and his nerves beginning to fray, he couldn't recall his name. "Second, see that bush?" The man pointed across the intersection of Main and 8th toward a large juniper. It loomed behind a wooden bench, a bus stop that had never seen a bus. Just one more artificial detail of this place. Once a week, an old woman who was losing her mind sat all day long on that bench, waiting for a bus that would never come. "I'm going to cross the street now," the man said. "Meet me behind that bush in 3 minutes." Before Ethan could respond, the man had turned away. Ethan watched him trudge across the empty intersection as the overhead traffic light changed from yellow to red. He waited. Part of him screaming that something had come off the rails, should have been Kate here to meet him, that he'd needed to go home right now. The man reached the other side of the street and disappeared behind the bush. Ethan waited until the traffic light had passed through 3 cycles, then he stepped out from under the awning and started into the street. Crossing, he finally remembered the man's name, Bradley Imming. Up and down Main was all quiet. It unnerved him, the stark emptiness of the street, the dark buildings, the single traffic signal humming above him as it cast alternating swaths of green, yellow, and red onto the snow.
He arrived at the bench, moved around the bush. Something bad was going to happen. He could feel it. A premonitory thrumming behind his eyes like a warning bell. He never heard the footsteps, just felt a warm push of breath against the back of his neck a half second before the world went black. His first instinct was to fight, his hand digging back into his pocket, probing for the knife. The ground hit him hard, the side of his face shoved into snow, the weight of what must have been several men crushing down on his spine. He smelled the sweet, rich funk of the dairy again. Bradley's voice whispered in his left ear, "You just settle right on down." "The fuck are you doing?" "You didn't strike me as a man who would willingly wear a hood. I read you right?" "Yep." Ethan strained, one last-ditch effort, to force his arm out from under his chest, but it was no use. He was thoroughly immobilized. "We're gonna take a little walk around town," Imming said. "Get you good and disoriented." Kate didn't say anything about this. "You want to see her tonight or not?" "Yes." "Then this is how it has to be. These are what you call non-negotiable terms, or we could just call the whole thing off right now." "No, I need to see her." "We're going to get up now. Then we'll help you up. You aren't going to take a swing at me or anything, are you?" "I'll try to restrain myself." The weight lifted. Ethan caught a desperately needed breath. Hands grabbed him under his arms, hauled him onto his feet, but didn't let go. They led him out into the intersection of Main and 8th, Ethan clinging to the sense that he was facing north. Imming said, "Remember pin the tail on the donkey? We're gonna spin your ass around, partner. But don't worry, we won't let you fall." They spun him for a good 20 seconds, fast enough that the world went on spinning even after they had stopped. Imming said to the men, "Let's take him that way." Ethan was dizzy on his feet, swerving like a drunk stumbling home after last call, but they kept him upright. They walked a long time, far past the point of Ethan having the foggiest idea of where he was. Nobody spoke. There was only the sound of their breathing and their footsteps in the snow. Finally they stopped. Ethan heard a creaking sound, like something opening on a rusty hinge. Imming said, "Just a heads up, this part's a little tricky. Turn him around, boys. I'll go down first. And check the knot on the back of his hood again." When they'd turned him 180 degrees, Imming said, "We're going to lower you onto your knees." The location of his voice had changed, almost like he was underneath Ethan's feet now. Ethan's knees hit the snow. He felt the cold bleed through the denim. Imming said, "I'm taking hold of your boot, putting it on a step. You feel that?" The sole of Ethan's right boot touched the narrow side of a 1x4. "Now put your other boot beside it. Good. Boys, I'll hold his arms. Sheriff, go on and take another step down." Even though he couldn't see, Ethan felt as if he were perched over a great height. He stepped down onto the next rung. "Boys, put his hands on the top rung." "How far of a drop is it?" Ethan asked. "Or do I even want to know?" "You got about 20 more steps to go." Imming's voice sounded distant, far below him now, and it echoed. Ethan ran his hands across the rung to gauge its width. The ladder was rickety. It shifted and groaned and shuddered with each descending step. When his boots finally reached the hard, broken surface below, Imming grabbed him by the arm and dragged him several steps away. Ethan heard the ladder rattling, the other men starting down, and again, the grind of that rusty hinge. Somewhere above, a door banged shut. Imming moved around behind him and untied the knot. Off came the hood. Ethan stood on the most rotten-looking concrete he'd ever laid eyes on. He looked at Imming. The man held a kerosene lantern that muddied his face in a collage of light and shadow. Ethan said, "What is this place, Bradley?" "Know my name, do you? How nice. Before we get to what this place is, let's have us a chat about whether or not you'll be breathing long enough to find out. Whether you get to come with us, or if we kill you where you stand." The sound of shuffling steps spun Ethan around. He stared into the eyes of two young men in black hoodies, each holding a machete and glaring at him with an intensity that suggested they might actually want to use them.
"You were given a warning," Brad said. "No chip, or don't bother coming."